And our last word in business is an FBI warning. Federal authorities have issued an advisory about video girl Barbie. The doll has a camera lens in her necklace and a video screen in her back. She can capture 30 minutes of footage, which is downloadable to a computer. Mattel is marketing video girl Barbie to, quote, budding filmmakers. Now, the FBI has issued a memo to other law enforcement officials to be mindful of this device. They are worried that child pornographers could use it. Not to dismiss the seriousness of that concern, but Bureau clarifies this is just advice for law enforcement, not to consumer safety alert. Many parents may be mindful of another possible threat posed by video girl Barbie. Instead of being captured in embarrassing moments that later turn up on reality TV shows, those cute kids might soon be capturing embarrassing videos of their parents. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. Last month in the Gulf of Mexico, scientists set out on an expedition to see how the Gulf ecosystem is doing after the BP oil spill. Yesterday on the program, we heard from NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, who joined them on the trip. He told us about a mini-sub being used to explore the seafloor and to examine firsthand the damage done. Well, today, Richard gets a seat in the sub and takes us with him.
To start our trip to the seafloor, three of us scrunch into the titanium hull of a submarine named Alvin on the rear deck of the research vessel Atlantis.
Doghouse, take tension on the main, release the latch and lower away when ready.
The descent through half a mile of inky black water is gentle, almost meditative. And when the sub's lights finally illuminate the bottom, the scene is serene. Fish and shrimp paddle around near the seafloor, going about their business, and crabs scuttle along the bottom.
So the surface doesn't look black and covered with oil in that sense.
No. And it I don't think it would.
Yet biologist Samantha Joy from the University of Georgia quickly notices things that aren't quite right down here. A once magnificent fan coral is covered with brown fuzz, dead.
We're going to be heading towards Sleeping Dragon, target 19.
Pilot Mike Skoronsky guides us past a mound of methane ice the size of a school bus. It's home to creatures adapted to living near natural petroleum seeps. And as we glide along, suddenly the texture of the seafloor changes.
We're now cruising over a spot and looking at it through the downward-facing camera, and it looks like cottage cheese. Is that typical?
No, it's not typical. It should just be flat, boring gray, and it's brown, you know, very porous-looking, sponge-like material.
Joy says it looks a lot like samples she collected in September.
That stuff contained a good bit of oil. So I think this is, we're getting into the area where there's been substantial deposition of oil on the bottom.
And the question foremost on her mind is, what is all this brown muck doing to life on the seafloor?
We're heading back to target 7 to pick up the camera, and then I'll call you to drop weights.
Once the Alvin lets go of its iron weights, the sub rises gently to the surface.
Sub's on deck.
And back on board the Atlantis, the scientists go to work, examining many dozens of seafloor samples collected by the Alvin and by a shipboard instrument called a multicorer. There's a familiar pattern. Seafloor samples taken within a few miles of the Macondo well are covered with a 2-inch layer of muck that looks like chocolate pudding. Laura Beer from Joy's lab says you'd almost want to taste it.
Looks like about 55% chocolate.
I'm holding up for the 72%.
Me too.
Humor softens a grim reality. This material is full of dead animals, worms being the most obvious, that were either smothered by the brown gunk or poisoned by it. Joy needs lab tests to figure out its exact composition, but judging by previous samples, she knows what to expect.
It's oil and mucus and marine debris, and
everything else that's pulled out it through the water column when it came down. So when you're this close in, you could also get some tar and asphalt that's just coming out of the wellhead and rolling down slope.
Samples she's tested from her previous trip contain far less than 1% oil, she says. But that's still 1,000 times more oil than you'd usually find in Gulf mud. Her colleague, Andreas Teska, from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, says most of this pudding is probably oil from the BP well that has since passed through the digestive systems of all sorts of animals on its way to the seafloor. You know those spring algae blooms that sometimes choke coastal bays?
We think that something similar has happened here. It was not a spring bloom, but an oil bloom. And we are looking right now at the remnants of this oil bloom.
Regardless of how it got there, Samantha Joy says this brown muck is killing life that lives on the bottom, and it's not just a passing thing.
Because it's going to take, I would suspect, years for the system to recover, and it's going to take more time for certain components of the system to recover.
Like that dead fan coral. Ian McDonald from Florida State University says it was likely 500 years old when the brown muck came along to snuff it out.
That really was one of these sort of simple examples of that really hit home to me exactly what I've been concerned about.
There are still government officials and scientists who want more proof before they are willing to say that a lot of BP oil did end up at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. McDonald certainly respects that skepticism. It's a healthy element of science.
At the same time, the evidence piles up, and then after a while you say, well, gee, there is oil on the bottom. And I think, as a simple statement at the end of this cruise, I have to say, gee, there is oil on the bottom, and that's too bad.
The scientists are now analyzing their samples back in their labs on solid ground to understand better what they saw at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a wish for this holiday season, that everyone read a terrific book, and she has some to recommend. She says she doesn't care whether you read the books on her 2010 Best of the Year list electronically or the old-fashioned way.
Sometimes there is justice in the world. That was my first thought when I heard that Patti Smith had won the National Book Award this fall for her glorious memoir, Just Kids, which has just come out in paperback. Smith wrote the book to honor Robert Mapplethorpe, her youthful partner in love, art, and ambition. But Just Kids is also a celebration of the frayed beauty of New York City in its so-called years of decline, the late 1960s into the 70s. Early in her memoir, Smith likens herself to the iconic Audrey Hepburn, a young girl full of pure yearning. Smith says that she and the more brooding Mapplethorpe were a curious mix of Funny Face and Faust. Another standout work of nonfiction this year also explores a famous relationship that defied convention. Hazel Rowley's biography of the marriage of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, called simply Franklin and Eleanor. Rowley charts the evolution of the Roosevelt Union from a standard-issue high society alliance to something we don't even have a label for. Maybe semi-open marriage comes closest. Speaking of conformity and rebellion, Rebecca Traister's so very smart and lively book about the 2008 presidential campaign called Big Girls Don't Cry teases out how our reigning cultural narratives about femininity and playing nice came to wield so much power during the campaign and finally in the voting booth. For all its daring allure, early 20th century American detective fiction pretty much played by the rules when it came to the standard issue look of its detective heroes. Sam Spade and company were white straight males who were quick to pull the trigger on any characters who were different. One enormously popular detective hero, however, who smashed the stereotype was Charlie Chan, the subject of a fascinating mishmash of a book also called Charlie Chan by Chinese-born scholar Yunta Huang. In the late 19th century, ordinary people, mill girls, garment workers, and miners, embraced the revolutionary idea that by joining together, they might better their lives. Philip Dray's spectacular narrative history of the American labor movement called There Is Power in a Union reads like a novel filled with dramatic acts of barbarism and bravery. This nonfiction best of the year list has turned out to be composed of stories and people who refuse to play by the rules, so I'll end it with two other out-of-the-box mentions. First, Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, the unforgettable and, yes, inspirational World War II tale of Louis Zamperini, Olympic athlete and prisoner of war. Zamperini's story puts to shame all of us these days who use the word survivor casually. Second, two books by Gabrielle Burton, a writer now in her 70s, whose near-lifelong obsession with Tamsin Donner, the wife of the leader of the notorious Donner Party, inspired her to write a fabulous on-the-road feminist memoir called Searching for Tamsin Donner, as well as an evocative recreation of Tamsin's lost journal called Impatient with Desire. Since we're on to fiction now, here are my top picks. Certainly Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, a novel about a marriage, deserved all of its applause, despite the literary spitball fight over Franzen's demigod status. My personal favorite novel of the year was Lionel Shriver's So Much for That, a moving black comedy about the emotional and financial cost of health care in America. I also admired David Mitchell's beautiful novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which traces the life of its title character, who starts working in 1799 on a small European outpost in the harbor of Nagasaki, Japan. Finally, Gary Steingart's novel, Super Sad True Love Story, moves at warp speed, telling a dystopian but comic story about a future where books are derided as objects that smell like wet socks. I can never close out a literary year without giving a nod to mystery fiction. The late Stieg Larsson's last Lisbeth Salander novel, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, deservedly overpowered all. But this was the year I also belatedly discovered suspense writer Tana French. French's police procedurals about the Dublin murder squad, including this year's Faithful Place, are brilliantly dark and moody. I want to end by doffing my hat not to a book, but to an independent bookseller and small press publisher. David Thompson was known throughout the mystery world. He died suddenly this year at 38. David introduced me to the wonders of noir writers like Reed Farrell Coleman, Daniel Woodrell, and Martin Limone. His legacy is a reminder to all of us who love books that, as someone once said about the late critic Irving Howe, enthusiasm is not the enemy of the intellect.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find links to all the books on her Best of the Year list, along with links to excerpts of those books and Maureen's original reviews of some of those books, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
The leading cause of death for toddlers in the United States is not poisoning or medical ailments or accidents around the home. By far the biggest killer of children is car crashes. Today in Washington, the National Transportation Safety Board holds a forum on car seat safety, and some of the recommendations could mean wholesale changes in how Americans transport their kids. NPR's Russell Lewis reports.
One morning this week in Birmingham, Alabama, Alexandria Page pulled her car into a parking garage. She wasn't looking for a spot, but the car seat installation team from Children's Hospital.
What we're going to do is get your little sweet pea out, and I'm just going to make sure that we have the harness straps in the car seat in the correct position before we get started.
Paige is here with her 9-month-old son, Peyton, to get a new car seat installed, and she's excited to finally have her son's rear-facing seat flipped around so she can see him.
I've seen in other cars, babies his age, I've seen them front-facing, so I just always thought, okay, once he comes out of the infant seat, he faces front ways.
She must wait a few months, though. Alabama, like most states, requires rear-facing car seats be used until toddlers weigh 20 pounds and are at least a year old. But Julie Farmer of the hospital's Child Passenger Safety Resource Center tells Paige that's just the minimum.
The best choice is for you to keep your child rear-facing as long as possible, not only because of the law, but because, well, of the law of gravity, I guess you could say.
The reason is simple physics. In a head-on collision, a rear-facing car seat spreads the energy of the crash across the toddler's entire back, not just a narrow portion of a tiny baby. In fact, studies have shown that toddlers in a rear-facing car seat are 5 times safer than those who face forward. In the U.S., 5 children a day die on average in car crashes. That's frustrating to pediatricians like Ben Hoffman.
I think we've become immune to this. I think it happens so frequently and with such regularity that we've lost focus on how important it is. And I think that we're so reliant on cars to get us from point A to point B that we've sort of accepted it as the price of doing business.
Hoffman also teaches at the University of New Mexico and is a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. For a couple of years, that organization has wrestled with changing requirements to recommend all toddlers sit facing the rear much longer. In Europe, that already happens. Most 4-year-olds in Sweden are transported that way.
Cultural change is very slow. The United States is a society that doesn't like to be told what to do.
That's Elisa Baer of the website thecarseatlady.com. For more than 30 years, she and her mother have worked to strengthen and expand state car seat laws.
I do feel like we're failing the children. Children do not have a voice. We have to be their voice and we have to be their advocates.
At today's National Transportation Safety Board Forum, the issue will get a very public airing. Also on tap is a proposal to require babies be buckled into car seats on airplanes rather than being held on their parents' laps. The NTSB has long pushed the FAA to make this change, which allows infants under 2 to fly for free. NTSB Chairwoman Debbie Hersman says it would require parents to buy an extra seat, but it would be much safer.
When you get on an airplane, you're expected to fasten your seatbelt on takeoff and landing and during turbulence. The same should be true for children.
Flying is still the safest mode of travel. Safety experts applaud the call for changes and hope the added cost of flying won't force some families to drive to their destinations rather than fly. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Birmingham, Alabama.
The demand for dolls, though, is up.
She totally gets me. We're friends for all time, my American girl. Hey.
It's been a good year for dolls, with sales up 12% over last year, according to market research firm NPD Group. And that's not even counting year-end holiday sales. Consumers have so far spent more than $1.5 billion on dolls and doll accessories. But it's not just the doll market that's growing.
Sparkle lights, princesses, Barbie girl.
Barbie sparkle lights, princess dolls light up.
Some of the new personalities on the doll shelf make Barbie seem downright puny. Dolls have gotten bigger in size. We ask reporter Ann Zimmerman into our studio to find out more about this. She covers the doll industry for the Wall Street Journal.
A fashion doll, typically fashioned like a Barbie doll, they're about 11 inches. And now these manufacturers are making dolls from 18 to 21 inches. There's the popular Disney princesses, Ariel, Tiana. They're now 18 inches tall. There's a line of private label dolls that Toys R Us has come out with, exclusive to them, called Journey Dolls. Again, 18 inches tall.
Has something changed to make manufacturers do this?
I think about 10 years ago, manufacturers noticed that girls were starting to, what they call, age out of dolls at a younger age. They were giving them up at around age 6. Barbie started appealing to younger and younger girls. Disney came out with a line of their princesses, and that appealed to younger girls, so they came out with a line of Barbie princesses to compete. So girls were aging out of them. I think also manufacturers looked at American Girl Doll. These are 18-inch dolls, very expensive, $100. So they did very, very well during the recession. While sale of toys weren't great, American Girl dolls went up by 7% in 2008, which is amazing. So I think manufacturers looked at that and said, this has staying power.
Although, if you go to Amazon.com toy section and you sort of get down to dolls, it looks like at least there Barbie and Barbie accessories dominate the bestseller list.
Absolutely. Barbie is still the undisputed queen of the doll aisle, but her growth has slowed.
Has anybody a theory on why girls gave up dolls at a younger age and also what they're doing instead of playing with dolls?
What they left for? They left for computer-based games and social media sites.
So in a way, interacting with real people, but not in a face-to-face way.
Right. Exactly.
Anne, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Thank you.
Anne Zimmerman is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.